Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson. I am happy to welcome to Talk Nation Radio this week Dave Lindorf. He is a journalist, a muckraker, a blogger. He created back in 2004 his own blog called ThisCan'tBeHappening.net, same title as a wonderful book by Dave Lindorf, and he has expanded ThisCan'tBeHappening.net into a news collective with several other writers. Dave Lindorf, first of all, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you, David. Thanks for having me on.
Been wanting to have you on for forever. You recently lost, that is, the world lost, one of your writers at ThisCan'tBeHappening.net named Chuck Young. Do you want to talk a minute about who Chuck Young was?
Yeah, and I would encourage people to go to our site and read the obit, which is on the homepage still, and has a link to an obit that they did, an excellent obit they did in Rolling Stone, where he wrote, he kind of took over the Hunter Thompson chair at Rolling Stone for a number of years and wrote some of the best journalism that the magazine has had. He wrote in that kind of vein, that gonzo vein, but with a real political edge and an incredible insight into the social importance of rock and roll, particularly the more recent versions of it, you know, punk and that kind of thing, and found the politics of it. But he also was the person who got Noam Chomsky and Howard Zinn into the pages of Rolling Stone, which was, you know, a major breakthrough for both of them. I mean, Noam Chomsky, that's as close as Noam Chomsky's gotten to mainstream journalism, was Chuck's piece. We had, you know, when Chuck joined us, he wrote a few pieces, and then, you know, what really fired him up was the Occupy movement. Chuck was down there the first day. He saw the importance of it right away and hung out there. And you know, I would encourage people to read his work. We're going to probably put a book out of our coverage of Occupy, and most of it was Chuck's because he lived in Manhattan. And he writes with a great deal of humor and really funny. I mean, fall down funny, but it captures the reality of things in a way that mainstream, you know, dull mainstream journalism just always misses. And I think he nailed the Occupy movement so well. It was just incredible coverage. So I just encourage people to go there. Well, it's a big loss. He died of brain cancer after a year and a half fight against it.
I will very much be looking forward to seeing that book, and people should go and check out every day ThisCan'tBeHappening.net, because it can't be happening, but it is. I was looking at the list of your books, Dave, and one that I was quite fond of from the moment it came out was called The Case for Impeachment, Legal Arguments for Removing President George W. Bush from Office. Of course, George W. Bush is off painting himself in the bathtub. He was never removed from office. He just ran out of time. We now have a replacement. How's the lack of accountability for presidential abuses looking to you these days?
Oh, my God. I mean, you know, we're part of it is we're paying for, at the time I wrote the book, I said that if we don't impeach, and I know you were saying a similar thing at the time, because we shared a lot of panels during that period.
Indeed.
But you know, I was saying at the time, as were you, that if we don't impeach these guys, we leave the stage completely open for people to do even worse abuses. And, you know, at the time, I have to say, I assumed that the danger was another rabid Republican coming in with even, you know, more insidious plots against the freedom and the Constitution. And little did I suspect that the very next president would be the one that would carry things, and a Democrat would be the one to carry things to extremes that we didn't even contemplate in our nightmares from what was being set up by Cheney and Bush. I mean, really, some of the things that Obama has done have gone way off the deep end. You know, just the idea of the targeted killings being just done at presidential whim, the expansion of drone wars to become sort of just a routinized part of American policy anywhere. They'll fire them off, and now we see this just the way it works. Look at what I was talking about when we were setting up the sound here about how the U.S. it just responds to everything militarily, like the Ebola outbreak. The Cubans send 160 doctors and nurses to go fight, help these poor African nations, medically underserved African nations, do something to slow down the spread of this plague. And the U.S. sends 3,000 troops.
Yeah, I've been laughing at these headlines. President Obama sends 3,000 troops to fight Ebola. Now, if you hadn't heard about Ebola, you would think it was a nation or a tyrant. Are they going to use missiles and drones? What are they going to fight Ebola with? And of course, the people who say, well, the only thing we have is the military, might as well use it for something good instead of something bad. But of course, it's an excuse to get 3,000 troops into a part of Africa that they are never going to leave, and they aren't trained or equipped to actually...
It said they're going to set up a command and control center. That's what it's about.
Yeah, yeah. So what is Cuba doing in terms of its foreign relations at this time?
Well, they certainly aren't trying to gain control of mineral resources in Africa. I mean, that's what the United States is after.
Yeah.
And this harks back to the Haitian earthquake, which the U.S. saw as a terrific opportunity to go in and further gain absolute control over Haiti. And when they got there, it took them quite a while to get there, and they came in aircraft carriers and Navy. It was all Navy flotilla that went down there. Most of the time they stayed on the ships because they were afraid to go into the Port-au-Prince earthquake damage zone until they had all these armed boots on the ground, as they put it. But when they got there, they found 300 or more Cubans, doctors, already had taken over the damaged hospital and got it up and operating, and had tent hospitals, and they were treating people, in this devastated city. They even offered, as you said, to send the doctors, badly needed doctors, to New Orleans after the Katrina fiasco, and sadly, the United States turned them down, and I think probably many people died because those doctors weren't there. It was a terribly underserved area at the time.
It's an incredible level of arrogance that we think we can, that the rest of the world wants our help in ways that they say they don't, and that their offers of help to us are an affront to our dignity. I wanted to talk about an issue that you've been writing about extensively, and that is the ongoing crisis and catastrophe in Ukraine, and the claims that have been made and dropped, and new claims made about possible causes for escalated war in Ukraine. What's happening there?
Well, this is just an unbelievable thing first of all, let's go way back in history. That the Ukraine is not a long-standing nation. It's actually been a kind of a battleground of major powers and occupied by major powers or been annexed by major powers for most of its existence. And it was, for example, it's been part of Austria-Hungary, it's been part of Poland, it's been part of Russia, and probably if any place has more claim to it than any other, it would be Russia. The languages are virtually indistinguishable. They're more like accents from what I've talked about. You know, I've talked with Ukrainians and Russians, and both, and both agree. I mean, it's also, you know, it's a country of, what, 46 million people adjacent to Russia's 154 million, but it is actually, many of those people are intermarried. Ukrainians marry Russians, Russians marry Ukrainians. There's, you know, there's 46 million Ukrainians in Ukraine, many of them Russian-speaking, and there are millions of Ukrainians living in Russia who are married to Russians and or just living in Russia. Khrushchev was a Ukrainian, the head of the Soviet Union for, you know, most of the Cold War, was a Ukrainian. And
But somehow Russian accents in Ukraine are a threat to U.S. national security.
Well, this is ludicrous. I mean, what you know, to move into the more modern world, when the Soviet Union was folding up, I guess it was during the Reagan and then the first Bush administration, all the negotiations were going on about what was happening in Eastern Europe. James Baker, the Secretary of State, cut a deal with Gorbachev, and he said, if you pull your troops out of East Germany, this was around 1989-90, if you pull your troops out of East Germany and you allow the two Germanys to reunify and you pull your troops out of the East Bloc countries from Warsaw and let them go their own way, we will not advance NATO into those countries. NATO stays in the NATO countries, and that was the deal. And I think George H.W. Bush actually stuck with that that deal. I'd have to check, but I'm pretty sure that's true, which wouldn't surprise me because it was his Secretary of State who cut the deal. But when Clinton came in, he promptly broke it. He started this campaign to put these so-called anti-missile missiles in Poland, right on Russia's border, to bring the Baltic states into NATO. They started pushing to get Georgia in NATO. I think they put Hungary in NATO. You know, there was a whole campaign to move NATO forward. NATO should have been disbanded at that point because it was a Cold War relic, and it really, Russia was not an enemy. There was no intent of Russia to do anything except try to restore its economy and, you know, recover, actually build a democratic system after communism collapsed. And instead, the U.S. began this aggressive thing of pushing a threatening military up against Russia's borders. And Russia responded. They, you know, they saw the anti-missiles as a attempt to give the U.S. a first strike ability that would prevent a Russian retaliation. The U.S. tried to claim that these anti-missiles were for protection of Europe against Iran, an Iranian nuclear attack, which was, you know, the Iranians didn't have a nuclear weapon, still don't, and didn't have a intercontinental missile that could reach Europe. And then if you draw a line from Iran through the Polish sites for these anti-missile missiles, you find that the only thing they'd protect against that a Iranian non-existent nuclear missile would be Finland. It's like, what if you wanted to block Iranian missiles, you'd put the anti-missiles down in Romania and maybe maybe conceivably Austria, but not Poland. So, you know, there was all that. So now you get to Ukraine, which is the big issue, because you, not only is Ukraine this large country that butts up against a lot of Russia's border, but it also has the only southern port for the Russian Navy, the one in Sebastopol, so that's in Crimea, and so the Russian fleet, southern fleet, that gives it any kind of ability to have a navy in the Mediterranean, or you know, full year-round access to the Atlantic, is Sevastopol. And it's on a, it was on a long-term lease, sort of like Guantanamo, you know, with Ukraine, with a lease which, by the way, allowed Russia to have 20,000 troops in Ukraine, in Crimea, to protect its base. And so when the U.S. Pushed, financed with, I think, $5 billion, overturning of the elected government in Ukraine, and helped to install its own, you know, right-wing government there. This was just earlier this year. Russia saw this as a huge threat, not just to the polity of the Ukraine, but to its naval base. So the first thing they did is they annexed Crimea, which is, I think, 90% Russian speakers, after a plebiscite that they rushed through that went 99 or 98% for annexation with Russia. We called it an invasion, but there wasn't any need for an invasion. There were troops, Russian troops, right there to make sure that there wasn't any violence. And,
We in the nationalistic misuse of the term "we," you and I didn't.
Yeah. Right. And so the U.S. called it an invasion, you know, and tried to compare it to the Anschluss, which was ludicrous because the army was just there.
It was already there.
Yeah, and there wasn't any shots fired. It was just making sure that the Ukrainian forces who were in Ukraine didn't do anything, and they didn't, and they were allowed to leave. And you know, it was actually a fairly peaceful transition. But then you had when the Putsch government came in with, you know, with the U.S. kind of picking the leadership of it, that you started having this push for repressing the Russian speakers who predominate in the eastern part of the Ukraine. And they were talking about laws to outlaw the use of Russian and other minorities. And so the Russians that lived there got scared, rebelled, and said they wanted to secede like
Crimea
did. And Ukraine responded with sending in troops and heavy weapons and started bombarding the cities there. So it's a very one-sided thing, actually. The Russians were not, clearly, were not sending in an army. I thought the best interview I saw on this was a press conference that was held by the so-called prime minister of the Donetsk People's Republic, and he was sitting with the guy who was their military chief, and they were being questioned about the turnaround in fortunes. They'd been getting pushed back into their, you know, the major cities by the Ukrainian forces, and then suddenly they did a counteroffensive, and the Ukrainian forces just collapsed and fled westward. So at this press conference, they were being asked about this change in fortunes and why they were suddenly becoming more successful on the battlefield. And one American reporter who wasn't identified, you could hear him in the background, asked them, well, isn't it because there's 1,000 Russian troops helping you? And remember, we're talking about tens of thousands of fighters on both sides and stuff. And the guy looked at him and he said, If there was a Russian invasion, you know, supporting us, it wouldn't be 1,000 troops, and we'd already be in Kiev. And he's right. I mean, if the Russians came in, they wouldn't come in with 1,000 troops. There may be, what they said was that there were Russians who were volunteering to come in and fight, which was also true in the battles in Yugoslavia and elsewhere. And it certainly is true with the U.S. We send people in all the time into other countries as, you know, either, you know, quote, volunteers or as mercenaries. And in fact, there are U.S. mercenaries fighting with the Ukrainian forces.
But what do you make of these claims that are reported as straight and verified news on the front page of the New York Times and all the U.S. media that Russia has invaded and NATO has photographs, and here are the, you know, in a sort of Colin Powell-esque presentation, here's the evidence of a Russian invasion of
Ukraine. It's really funny, isn't it? There are no photographs. They keep saying they have photographs, and I have Googled and Googled for photographs because I've wanted to include them in my articles, and there are none.
Well, no, there's a blurry satellite images.
Yeah, yeah, and that one was funny. The satellite image supposedly showed what were supposed to be a line of five heavy artillery pieces, mobile artillery, that were supposedly pointing westward. I mean, who the hell knows whether you flip the image? You know, but they were in a field, and you know, I looked at this thing and I thought, wait, this is not how heavy artillery is emplaced. You don't put it in an open field with no protection, no camouflage, and in a straight line, perfect for a strafing run by a plane to, you know, hit all five at once. There were no piles of shells around them. There were no support vehicles, just these five things and standing there. And then, you know. So I remarked on that in a piece, that this did not look like how you set up in a war zone your heavy artillery. You put them behind berms, you put them in the woods, you put them somewhere, but you don't put them where a sniper would be able to pick off all of your personnel working around the firing of the things. And then I got a letter from a guy in Texas, and it was included a whole bunch of links to photographs. And he said, you know, just speaking as a, you know, someone from an agricultural state and looking at these pictures, I think these are combines, and it's harvest season in Ukraine. And I looked, and, you know, the images he sent of combines with that pipe that feeds the grain into a waiting truck looks exactly like these things. And it makes much more sense. And most of his pictures showed these things being run in rows. They'd go in formation across the fields.
So we've advanced from Winnebagos as chemical weapons factories to combines as artillery.
It's harvesting combines, yeah. Unbelievable. And I'm sure he's right that's what these are. They're in a field with rows, you know, very clear rows in it. But
NATO sort of was put out there to make this claim rather than the national leaders of NATO making it. And then it sort of went nowhere, and the war didn't go the way NATO wanted it to go, and they dropped it, and they'll make some other claim. The one before
this... There's so many claims that have been dropped, nobody talks about it. The press never comes back.
Right, right. The airplane, you know, someone started on our do-it-yourself site, diy.rootsaction.org, someone started a petition that's taken off. Let's actually go back and have a real investigation of the airplane claim. And of course, there's been this preliminary
Flight 17.
Right, right. Talk about that claim and what happened to it.
Well, that's an interesting one. I interviewed Ray McGovern, who I know you're close to.
Sure.
Ray is, for your listeners, is a former CIA analyst who spent, I think, 27 years with the agency as an analyst, and actually was the guy who had the job of going into George H.W. Bush's office each morning and giving him the CIA's news analysis of the, you know, what was going on in the world each day. It was a pretty high level responsibility. And Ray said that his contacts at the CIA had told him that the analysts at the CIA were refusing to support the Obama administration's claim that the separatist rebels had shot down the Malaysian Flight 17 with a Russian-supplied high-altitude anti-aircraft, you know, Buck missile. And they were refusing to do it because they said the evidence simply was not there. And Ray said he was also told by his contacts at the CIA that what they actually believed at the CIA was that it was a Ukrainian military unit that fired the missile. And you get none of that in the U.S. Corporate media reporting. But if you think about it, the separatists had nothing to gain by shooting down that plane. At the time, they were actually winning in the battlefield. And by downing that plane, they would, as we have seen, because they've been accused of it fairly successfully in the media by, you know, the U.S. supported and the European, some of the European media, they would get the blame, and it would help to rally support for NATO action on behalf of the Ukrainian forces. So there was nothing to be gained by the separatists doing it, nor would the Russians be likely to have given a complicated high-altitude missile to the separatists, because, first of all, it wasn't needed. I mean, they were doing fine with low-altitude shoulder-fired missiles that shooting down the Ukrainian attack aircraft that were going after their forces, so, and also the helicopters that were being sent against them. And high-altitude planes were not a threat to them. The Ukrainians weren't doing high-altitude bombing or anything. They were doing, fighter bomber attacks at low level against troops. High-altitude bombing doesn't do any good against troops. That's more for civilian, decimating cities. And they weren't doing that.
So, Dave, we've got about 1 minute left. So where did this story go, and where does it stand?
Well, at this point, it's become, the Dutch investigators are in charge of a so-called international investigation. They're doing a fairly limited job. They haven't ever asked for the tapes of the Ukrainian air traffic controllers that were absconded by the Ukrainian government. So it's not a real investigation. But even so, they're only saying that it was probably a Russian Buk missile that took it down. But even if that were true, the Ukrainian forces had about 20 launchers of those Buk missiles, and the separatists had none. So at some point, it's going to have to come out that this was not the separatists that shot it down. It was the Ukrainians.
Well, it would be good for it to come out sooner the better, and in a major way. And if it does, I think we'll be reading about it at thiscan'tbehappening.net. We've been speaking with Dave Lindorf. You should read his books, you should read his writing, and the writing of the other journalists and muckrakers at thiscan'tbehappening.net. Dave, thanks for coming on Talk Nation Radio.
Thanks for having me on, David. Anytime.
This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. Take action at rootsaction.org. Help end war at worldbeyondwar.org. All past shows can be heard at davidswanson.org. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. If you are listening to a nonprofit station, please support that station. Talk Nation Radio is funded by contributors at davidswanson.org. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way. Until next time.